Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Good morning. That welcome and disclaimer was from our founder, Brian Brown. You are listening to the Brown Briefly. Today is Tuesday, July 13th, 2021. And this morning we have five Brieflys gathered via the magic of Zoom to discuss local, state, and national news and nonsense. We aim for honest, civil discussions based in truth and integrity. Welcome Lynn Kerrigan, Truman O'Brien, Kevin Jones, and Bruce Hallman. And I'm Gail Kellner, your host for this week's program. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to start by thanking Truman O'Brien at the controls in the Voice of Vachon studio. He will be piloting us via the airways on our 45-minute flight over the cultural and political landscape of our times and the 49 square miles of paradise surrounded by reality known as Vachon Island.
I love it.
Yes, surrounded by reality is true. True, true. Hey, and I do have one announcement. I may have to leave in the middle of our show today, but luckily I have Lynn Kerrigan here at the take over the helm. She's my trusty co-pilot.
Faithful sidekick.
There you go. Tonto, nice. No.
More Tonto than Robin, yes.
Yeah. Also, go ahead, Bruce.
Truman is a very versatile guy. I drove by the Voice of Vachon this morning about maybe 9 o'clock, and Truman standing outside holding the door open.
Yes.
Remote control through the window to try and change something on the board. Well, I don't know what it was, Truman.
Well,
it was very interesting to watch.
I have to tell you that I really messed up this morning big time. We have a monitor in the window, right? And so we've had it here for quite a while, but we haven't gotten the thing up and running. Because, well, a whole bunch of issues. But anyway, this morning I said, all right, this morning I'm going to do it. I'm going to have it all set up. So I got my iPad in here, and I got my iPad. It started mirroring, and everything mirrors, and it's working. And I'm going, all right, I got it finally. And then I started the show. When I started the show, my music went to the TV, not to the board. And so I was like, now what do I do?
Have no music?
No, I had no music. So I was scrambling around here like a madman trying to get that working. But anyway, I finally got it going. So,
knowing that you might not be here for our whole show, I may swap our order a little bit and pull something. Truman shared via email this week something from some of his acquaintances, friends down in
the South,
in Texas, yeah. Down in the South, down yeah. the South. Truman, can you talk for a minute a little bit about that? And then I thought maybe we could all talk and share a little bit about this idea of is communism taking over and ugh, should it?
Well, it was I can never say this right. Meme.
Yeah.
It said, as soon as everyone realizes that the Democrats are all communists, the sooner we'll be able to repair all the damage that they've done. And that, and there was a hammer and sickle, and you know that was the big scary headlines.
And, right.
And you know, I've had a couple of my buddies saying, you know, that, oh gosh, you know, as soon as we memorialize what was the gay bar there in Miami, the Eclipse or whatever it was called.
The Pulse nightclub?
The Pulse nightclub. That was it. As soon as we memorialize that, then we're going down the road to communism. I mean,
all things lead to communism,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah. And I wrote back and I said, well, you know, until we nationalize the steel industry and take over the airlines, and you know, I wouldn't be too worried about us going to communism, because that's what that's all about. Not not taking care of each other, you know.
Well, that's it. To me, the fact that anybody can say you're communist, if we're saying maybe let's give everybody health care, it is a redirection of some of the money, but it's a compromise to kind of keep capitalism going with some redistribution of wealth with people that would otherwise be starving in their children's basements.
Well, one thing I saw that I thought was interesting, it says, would you rather spend $2,000 in taxes or $8,000 in health care? You know? I mean, that was the question. And I guess that's maybe about right, you know? I haven't done the math, but that's what it sounds like. I have to admit, I'm for smaller government. I mean, I always have been. The old Republican mantra. And I think that the whole government run any program generally doesn't run all that well. I mean, look at what the VA did for years. You know, they were terrible. The bureaucracy is always so cumbersome that, you know, I don't know. I always have a problem with that. But we have to do something with our health care.
So. I used to ask my mother when she'd say those kinds of things how she liked her Medicare.
Yeah.
There was no touching her Medicare.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Evan, you have some thoughts to share with us this morning.
I hear this a lot, you know, in my line of work, if you will. And it just seems that more education is always a good thing, because the reality of these different governmental systems of a democracy, a socialist, a fascist government, a communist government, you know, maybe there's still a communal farm on Vashon somewhere, but I kind of doubt it. Perhaps there is, and our listeners may call in and let us know. But the whole notion of the communist collective, and that you are sort of told what you're going to do, and that you work for a common good where wealth is shared across all, governed by a central administration, is clearly not what we have. So I completely agree. The other reaction I had, Truman, was this Democrat has spent, you know, 20 odd years working on things that I can't tell you about, but it is clearly not in support of communism.
I'm very aware of that. Thank you.
Any other, Bruce, do you have some thoughts to share with us about this?
No, not really. It's just sort of like, I mean, as Kevin pointed out, that I mean, it's really people understanding terminology, you know, and socialism, communism, because of the Red Scare of the 1920s, you know, and the McCarthy sort of era of the 1950s, 40s and 50s. I mean, communism, ever since the Russian Revolution, has been the boogeyman for American capitalists.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just important to keep that context, that communism, in the way that most American conservatives use the term, has nothing to do with the reality of what is happening in the United States or in any communist country, for that matter. I mean, you know, there is no communism in the mindset of how most American conservatives use the term. No government exists anywhere like that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Go ahead, Lynn has a thought to share. And Kevin.
Two quick things, Bruce. What you're saying reminds me of Winston Churchill's famous statement that, you know, all forms of, you know, that democracy is, you know, is a bad form of government, except for all the others.
All the others, that's right.
You know, and I think that a lot of what we hear about, well, that's just communism, is another example of whataboutism. You know, that if the Democrats will say, well, doesn't everybody deserve health care? They'll say, yeah, but what about, you know, my taxes for this or that? It's a kind of a quick trope. I'm not quite sure I know the difference between a trope and a meme. They keep coming up is all I know, both of them. What I'm saying is I think there's some standard deflection that happens that ignores a deeper conversation about what we do have and how can we be fair given our distinct differences.
Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, it's what people don't tend to realize is if you go back to the Declaration of Independence, you know, it says that, you know, government, well, let me see if I can find it now, secure these rights. It says, you know, endowed by a creator with unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And then it goes on to say that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. When any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it's the right of the people to alter or abolish and institute a new government. So, you know, it's that idea that, governments are here to serve us, you know, and they're here for a purpose, and they're instituted by us. And what I think a lot of right-wing radicals do is they take that and say, all government's bad. And then we just need to get rid of government. And that's not what it's all about. It's about government reflecting who we are and responding to who we are. And that's the foundation document of who we are as a country. And I find that many of the so-called patriots who wear their hats on their head and declare themselves, you know, patriots, don't know what they're talking about.
You mean those guys that have the Confederate flag on their shoulder that they're waving?
Exactly. Traitors.
Yeah, those guys, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. There are those guys. You know, there will be some form of governance, right, or else you have anarchy. But there is that dynamic tension, right, between how much and what does government do. I'm just sort of fascinated by the Post in the sense that, you know, our last president was often quoted as saying it would be great if we got along with Putin. And Putin is clearly a communist, unless they've changed their, I guess they're now, they sort of pretend to be a democracy because they actually vote and have elections, but certainly their roots are in communism. And I'm just curious how your acquaintances square the kind of post that you shared with the idea that that our last president seemed awfully friendly with a bunch of communists.
Yeah, that is a very good question. And you know, they were saying, yeah, but he was tough with Putin. You know, he really towed the line, which boggles my mind because I don't see that at all.
Examples, please.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Well, you must have missed what happened in Helsinki.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I can tell you, you know, I was one of those guys that said, look, I didn't vote for Trump, but I give him the benefit of the doubt. A lot of people thought, yeah, this guy's great. Okay, let's see what he can do. When he stood up there in Helsinki and disregarded the intelligence community here in the U.S. and took Putin's word over that, that was the end for me. I said, you've got to be kidding me. I mean, what an idiot that guy is, you know. Ugh, sorry.
I think it may be helpful to clarify something for our listeners, and that there's two things at play here. There's a question of an economic system, and there the two polar ends of that are unbridled capitalism, and the other is what we call communism. The middle ground of that might be considered socialism, and then we have the other continuum, which is a political one, and it's a question of a dictatorship over an elected democratic system. And I would say Putin is definitely on the dictator end of things pretty far. How long has he been in power now? I can't even keep track. It's been over 20 years. And so I think that it's important to distinguish between an economic system and a political system.
Yeah, that's a good thing to point out. I appreciate that.
Yeah, we tend to blend everything together here, I think, just to overwhelm ourselves and enrage ourselves further because we're so addicted to that.
Yeah. I think my other something that I read this last week in the New York Times and was looking at the wealth disparity in this country and the reason why perhaps Democrats want to see a change in our economic system, not so much in our political system of self-governance and voting. In fact, I think the Democrats are the ones wanting voting rights and wanting to open it up so that people do indeed are the ones who are directing our government. But one of the interesting things I read was this problem of the of 1% of the population in the United States now holds 32% of the wealth. And the bottom 50% holds only 2% of that wealth. And in this combination of, you know, when you have that kind of situation, you have to ask yourself if that's kind of like, do we have economic royalists? Do we essentially, have we got a ruling class now that is, has so much power, and has, because wealth in this country is power, do we have a democracy left?
You just have to count the votes.
Yeah. Right. But tell me more what you mean when you say that, Bruce.
Well, as long as people have free access to the ballot box, you know, I mean, kleptocracies exist all over the world, you know, and, you know, and they can certainly influence elections, but they can't buy elections, you know. As long as people have access to the ballot box and free access to the ballot box, then, you know, the voice of the people can be heard, and the voice of the people can dominate governments and government structures. You know, when you begin to constrain that, and that's the big argument going on right now in D.C. and in states all across the United States, is are we going to be a democracy where people have access to the vote, or are we going to limit that and become a republic, in effect, that only has certain people having the vote? And that's the critical question before us right now. And so money doesn't rule unless you limit people's access to having a voice in their government. And that's what the kleptocracy in the United States right now is trying to do, trying to buy the elections by limiting who can vote.
Kevin, you want to chime in on this?
Yeah, and I agree with Bruce's comment, and I do want to point out that I think there might be some relationships here that tie these threads together. So Nancy MacLean, author of Democracy in Chains, is fond of pointing out in her research that the big money interests are very much behind a Republican strategy of suppressing the vote. And of course, now we have the other threat of creating laws that allow Republican legislators to revise, you know, the vote count. And the Koch Foundation is not C-O-K-E, the K-O-C-H Foundation, has been traced very directly to this. And so in a sense, the moneyed interests are very involved, and they certainly always have been. But they're also moving in a fairly successful way right now to not only suppress the vote, but authorize certain legislators to change the votes that come in. And also then to make sure that the courts have like-minded justices so that they will be okay with what's going on. And if you haven't read Democracy in Chains, I highly recommend it, because it opens your eyes to a lot of things that we see in the news today and what's happening in these struggles.
Lynn, go ahead.
Well said, both of you. I couldn't have said it better. I think the piece that I saw in the national news this week that made me a little more optimistic was the fact that the Democrats in Texas walked out of their legislature rather than have a quorum there so that the Texans could vote on their restrictive voting laws that they're trying to pass there. You know, we're a nation kind of born of insurrections, and we're coming down to the place where we are having some pretty serious disagreements. And I hope people will be able to see beyond the fray to see that we are actually fighting for these principles that you so clearly outlined. The principles of, is everybody going to get to vote or not? Or is it just going to be the wealthy people whose votes count because they have forced everybody else away from the ballot box? So remember those rather than, you know, arguing all over all these fine little nits.
All right. Thank you, Lynn. I'm going to move our conversation along a little bit. I'm mixing up the order, but I think everyone can manage that. Bruce, tell us a little bit. Bruce Hallman, fondly known here at the Briefly as a Guardian of the Galaxy. Bruce is also president of the Vashon Maury Island Historical Museum's board. Bruce, how did the event go on Saturday? I see you've got a nice visual behind you, but tell us for our radio listeners without that view.
Oh, it was fantastic. We had an interesting opening. We were opening sort of four things simultaneously. Most importantly, it's the beginning of a rolling opening, if you will, of a new exhibit that will formally open in November, first Friday, November 5th, called Natural Wonders, an island shaped by water. And it's basically an exhibit done in collaboration with the Vashon Nature Center to look at the natural history of Vashon Island. So all the plant, animal, and human communities that make up Vashon and the history of those. So we opened the geology section of that and the Audubon Habitat Garden, as well as a salmon walk that goes back to what's going to be installed, a rain garden that's being installed in the IGA parking lot. And so those three elements were all part of it. But the centerpiece was really an opening of an exhibit called The Whale People, Protectors of the Sea, which is a fabulous kind of IMAX type, you know, theater in the round kind of thing, with the centerpiece is a 3,000-pound killer whale pole that sits in the middle of the back area of the museum, surrounded by a screen that every Friday and Saturday evening through the end of August will be open to the public. And it's open to go back and see at any point. But another interesting part of it was there was a 24-foot whale pole that was on the island Saturday and much of Sunday at the museum that is called the Red Road Pole. And so it was a pole carved by Lummi, by the Lummi Nation. And it's making its journey back to Washington, D.C. over this summer, stopping at Indian reservations and threatened sites all across the country. And you can go online, just Google Red Road Pole, and you can find that and keep track of that journey as it goes through. So we had over 500 people in the back area of the museum. So it was a very substantial turnout and a very moving ceremony. We had representatives from the Puyallup tribe, Connie McLeod, who's head of the cultural area, and also a tribal board member. We had the carver from the Lummi Nation there. We had Israel Shotridge sing a song from the Tlingit Nation. We had Lana Jack from the Salila Wyom people of the Columbia River there, and Jack from the Ojibwe tribe. So it really represented that sort of what has become sort of an urban phenomenon in the United States, where you have Native Americans from all over congregating in urban areas. And certainly the Native people of that area, like the Shawbop people of Vashon Island, are still here, are still part of the Puyallup and Red tribe. But also we have a number of other Native people living on Vashon from all over the country. And so it was really a sort of multinational celebration, if you will, of Native people on Vashon and of the Red Road Pole and of the opening of the Natural Wonder exhibit. So I'm running on because there's just so much to say, but it was very, very impressive. And so any of you that were there know that. And if you missed it, we filmed it, and so it will be on the museum website shortly.
Nice. Gosh, Bruce, congratulations. That's such an amazing collaboration. I really am amazed by the vision that the Vashon Historical Association and Museum shows. Thank you.
Well, thanks. Yeah, it just goes to show you. I mean, this exhibit is really, the Whale People is done by the Natural History Museum, which is a a group of young people who moved to the island from New York City, who are very media savvy and who put this together, the Vashon Nature Center, the Heritage Museum, the Land Trust. I mean, you know, it's just a measure of the power of what gathering people together and collaboration can do. So,
communism, isn't it?
Yes.
Shame on you, Lynn.
And that collaboration. So thanks.
All right. Well, thank you, Bruce, and all your part in that. I'm so proud of not only you, but our whole island for having a museum like this and all the people that participate and make that happen. Wonderful. Lynn. Welcome Lynn Kerrigan, our former Georgia Peach poet, musician, academic activist, and provocateur. Lynn, what topic would you like to go back to? As we had our technical difficulties last week, was there something you'd like to bring up and talk about?
It was a little disjointed, but thanks to our friend Susan McCabe, who covered for all of y'all when your Zoom went out and we sort of struggled to keep going on the air. Truman sort of playing two roles, speaking as well as checking every known glitch to man, trying to get our Zoom internet connection back up. And it kind of failed. But while we went down to you, Gail, we were on air sort of struggling. So we got through most of the program just fairly disjointedly. And the only thing that I think I didn't mention that I would have liked to have is that I have, and I wanted to ask y'all about this. I had a little item that I was going to ask about the Seattle mayor's race, because I've been watching that unfold with the eight candidates that they have there. And there have been some quite good articles in the Seattle Times about some of the issues at hand. To me, the biggest one that's making a lot of news is the question about the homeless population, which is all over Seattle. You know, we have encampments everywhere. And there's a new initiative out called Compassion Seattle, where people are really kind of developing another project to get a lot of buy-in to try to finally develop some affordable housing in Seattle, rather than just put people in shelters or go after drug addictions or some of the mental health issues that all contribute. They all contribute, but the end result is there's no housing. And there used to be more of the single room occupancies in the little hotels that you know, went away with urban development. And we have good weather here. So we have, you know, quite the choice environment for people who are homeless. And to me, the debate is an interesting one, because it seems to me, and this is what I wanted to ask how you would frame this. As I understand it, the major debate has to do with, well, these are our citizens, homeless or not, and do they not deserve a voice, and do they not deserve kind of some inclusion in the planning for what will happen? That's the compassion part of it. On the other hand, I hear that there is often what happens is that on these fancy names, it hides something. And the other side of the coin seems to be saying that the big moneyed interests are behind the Compassion Seattle initiative, which are, you know, basically saying that they don't want their businesses blocked, and, you know, that the encampments everywhere are really bad for business, and that they see Seattle's recovery from the pandemic really tied to being able to bounce back economically here in Seattle. And so we have two major collision points, you know, a lot of people who are homeless and a lot of people who want the recovery to come economically first. And I'm just curious what y'all think about that.
So I don't see those as colliding. I think I see those as both wanting the same thing. And so they want it for different reasons. So what? You know, I mean, if it accomplishes what it needs to accomplish, and that is getting the folks off the street, go get them, you know?
I may not be expressing this, you know, perfectly. And I guess what I'm saying is it seems to me that's where the press is going, dividing in these two questions, and one being the people's voice versus the interest of the economy. And it you're right. There's no reason they have to be different. But it seems
Gail. I just wanted to take a little opportunity because I agree with Truman.
No. Somebody write this down.
So rarely I felt that I should really speak up. I agree. It's not an either or question. I think that it's a both. I mean, I think we all have an interest in being able to walk down streets and feel safe and feel that we have access to our city and that businesses are able to run. And at the same time, absolutely, my heart just pours out to these people who have no option but to be camping on sidewalks, you know, under the viaducts. It's, you know, I've lived here or my entire life. I remember a time before there was an I-5, and I have never, ever, ever seen this kind of homelessness in the 60 years that I've been on the planet. And it's really quite shocking what's happened, and it's been growing and growing worse. So I think that the press, perhaps, you know, they want a story, and maybe that's unfortunate in this case, because it doesn't have to be either or. It really, you know, is something all hands on deck kind of thing.
It needs to be both. In my mind, needs to be both. You got to have the economic development, and you have to have some compassion. Both, Kevin.
Yeah, I was kind of going back to, we talked at the top of the show about what, you know, what government should do, and how big it should be, and what areas does it focus on. And of course, you know, it's the incredible disparity that we see. You know, Richard Branson just launched himself into high Earth or low Earth orbit. He didn't actually get into orbit. No. But, you know, there's clearly tremendous wealth that a few share, and tremendous poverty that many have to endure. And clearly there are folks who are homeless who may have been abandoned by the mental health system, so that they're really, and maybe that, you know, I understand that they have some have a preference, right, for living on the streets, and that's fine. But there's a lot of people there who don't have that preference, and the opportunities that our current government is creating have been more and more challenged over the course of the several decades. And I recall a pre-I-5, actually, my dad took all of us kids out to see the blasting just north of Renton when they were putting in the freeway. And as a kid, yeah, I don't recall seeing this either. And now it is quite prevalent and sort of shocking.
Well, I mentioned it at all because this issue is partially what is helping to define the candidates. The candidates seem to be splitting down the middle. It's about 4-4 or 5-3 who is behind the compassionate Seattle movement. And it's certainly not the only voting point that we want people to look at. But you can see these are issues that people feel passionately about. And I'm with you. I don't want it to be either or choice or not. But I think sometimes when people don't go along with a major initiative, a couple of the comments I heard said that there was no funding, for example, allowed in the bill for the extra housing, that it was more the philosophy of the idea to be going forward, trying to find a compassionate middle for this, but the enactment itself didn't have any funding attached to it. So there's details, important details about how we fund things that we believe in and want and think that they'll improve Seattle. And I just encourage y'all to look at the votes and the candidates and the things they support. And not that we on Vashon would be voting for the Seattle mayor, but these bigger principles and these bigger issues are all over this country. And I think we're just an example. Gail.
I just wanted to thank you, Lynn, for bringing that up. And I'm going to move us along a little bit to Kevin. Welcome, Kevin. Jones, superhero of activism at the helm of Indivisible Vashon, tell us about your perceptions of the grinding wheels of justice regarding our number 45 president.
You know, we used to talk quite a bit about those grinding wheels of justice.
Yeah, I credit
Bruce actually with, I think, where I first heard the term. There they go. They're still active. You know, was it 15 counts, 10 against the bookkeeper and 5 against the organization, Trump's organization? I might have those numbers flipped, but I did hear just recently also that the bookkeeper has now been relieved of his job assignment at the Trump organization, which one theory is that they're basically trying to distance themselves from future liability, given the fact that he's now been indicted. But I guess certainly would like people's comments and thoughts about where we're headed. You know, the notion that a former president being indicted on criminal offenses is certainly a novelty in this country, maybe not totally, but certainly in recent history. We had a vice president, Agnew, who certainly got into plenty of trouble. And Nixon, avoided all of that with a leaving and then a pardon. But would this be a first, Bruce, to have a former president be indicted on crimes?
Interesting. Yeah, I can't think. I'll have to look. I'm not aware of any former president being prosecuted. There's certainly, Andrew Johnson and a few folks like that were sort of pilloried after their terms in office. But I don't think any were taken to court that I can remember. I'll take a look. We can come back to that next week.
So what about the insanity plea? Isn't that a possibility?
But half the country wouldn't go for that.
Well, I suppose.
Yeah, because they think everything's great. Right? Yeah.
Well, I keep waiting for a charge to come against Trump, because that's the only thing that will keep him out of another presidential bid. Is that not right? For him to have a felony charge or a felony indictment.
Well, no, he's going to replace Pelosi, don't you know, and then get rid of the other two and then move into the presidency again.
There you go.
I've done this research, Lynn. You can run for president of the United States as a felon. There's nothing
really?
In the Constitution.
Is that right?
No, I wasn't aware of
that. Keep that from happening, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, but I do think that it's important that we've also at the head of the show, we talked about economic disparity and that also disparity can translate into how people are treated under the law. And I think it would be a shame if there's evidence. And certainly Trump's attorney went to jail, Michael Cohen, for paying hush money to a couple of women that Trump had affairs with. And the unindicted co-conspirator was widely known as Trump. And so is he going to face the charges? Well, that particular case apparently has been dropped. So, you know, it'll be an interesting test in my view is, do we really have people in this country who are above the law? And whether this is a case that sort of adds to that database.
Terrifying.
Couldn't agree more. Any other thoughts on that subject before we move on? We've got a few minutes. Bruce, do you have something to say?
It's back to the grinding wheels of justice. I mean, they do grind slowly, and it's just the nature of it. It's, you look at all the cases that came up as a result of the 2020 election, all these sort of frivolous cases that were brought by Republicans and by the Trump administration, by Trump supporters, you know, to contest the election. I mean, those judges initially, you know, threw them out or whatever, but the ones that are working, we're just now beginning to see the first hearings. You know, this is, 9 months after the election? I mean, it's just the nature of a judicial system that you can trust is that it does not move too quickly. These are not sort of military courts. You know, these are public judicial courts that work in a prescribed manner. And so, I mean, you talk about 2024 election, even if Trump is indicted today, you know, the fact that that may not come to trial before 2024 is realistic. And you know, there's some reasons to speed up the trial system, but there's also reasons to have it move slowly. So,
okay, Kevin, and then Truman.
Yeah, I think Truman maybe was first on this topic.
Now I've lost my train of thought. Go ahead.
Kevin. Okay. Well, I was going to sort of do a segue into whatever's next, but I do hope that if you show up at the Strawberry Festival Parade, which is still, this parade is around the island, it's not just through town, so go on the website, the Vashon Chamber of Commerce website, and they have the parade route. And wave at the Invisible Vashon vehicle that'll be there with lots of banners and a couple of key phone numbers for your senators to call about passing the For the People Act. So we'll wave to you as you go by.
Let me just suggest that you use all your fingers when you wave.
We equality of fingers in our waves. I hope everybody returns that favor.
I got the train of thought back. It was the trial in Michigan where they, what are there, 9 attorneys that were going after the election. And boy, oh boy, it was just a real free-for-all, I guess. The poor court reporter had to take control and say, one at a time, Eric, you know, I can't get all this written. But the judge is looking at this like, boy, you folks are in trouble. And it sounded to me like he's going to go after the attorneys. For this frivolity that they brought to the proceedings.
Lynn?
I'm thinking about changing gears for a minute here, if we could turn away from that.
You've got three minutes left. Where would you like to turn?
I just wanted to mention the most exciting thing that I saw in the news over the last week, which was on last Wednesday, July 7th, in the paper, a fabulous op-ed on the Civilian Climate Corps, which has been proposed by Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, who have introduced the Civilian Climate Corps for Jobs and Justice Act to employ 1.5 million workers over the next 5 years and just get down to it immediately, trying to turn the clock back a little bit about the climate. To me, this is something that can bring everybody together and can redirect the United States away from this vicious infighting, you know, which is endless. I'm sick of it. And I want to see us figuring out how to save the planet and move forward. This is an issue that we all need to be working on. And so I was thrilled to see there's a law, legislation being introduced, and hope that we can come back to this.
Thank you, Lynn.
So are we talking?
Anyone else have some good news this week they came across that they'd like to share?
You had something in your notes about wildlife, and I just have to say, driving down my driveway a couple of days ago, 3 or 4 days ago, I came across a ringneck pheasant rooster and 2 young hens, and so I was very happy to see pheasants back on the island. And then about 2 days later, I heard the coyotes howling right at the bottom, right where these guys were. And I was very worried, but I can tell you that I did see the pheasants again. So they're safe. Go ahead, Kevin.
My experience, I walked out to the end of my driveway and 2 fawns ran past me literally like 5 feet away. And when mom was right behind him, she stopped and turned and redirected. But the young ones were like not afraid.
Oh, God. Pretty cool. Yeah. Okay, guys. Hey, we are out of time. So we'll see you all next week.